Hello.
And welcome to episode 28 of
Season to Taste.
There's actually been quite a hiatus from our point of view, but assuming that I edit this in good time, actually the hiatus for you, the listener, will have taken place before episode 27, so there's not really any point us apologising for it now, timey-wimey, and all that. Now, this is Season to Taste. It's a podcast where we watch one episode from each year of Doctor Who, and in episode 27, the randomizer, which I must go and get in a minute, selected season 17, Tom Baker's penultimate season, and we chose to watch The Creature from the Pit, which was the only colour Doctor Who story from the old era that I had never actually seen before. So it's the first time we've done a Season's Taste where I haven't seen the story in question before. So, Matt, what did you think of Doctor Who and The Only Way is Eileen?
Oh, God, that is awful. I couldn't help but think during episode 4 that there's probably 45 minutes of very good story in this, but unfortunately it lasts for 100 minutes. And I think if you did it now as part of the new series, you could have the nice twist that it was just trying to communicate and clear things up in 5 minutes, whereas this takes kind of 20 minutes after the main villain dies to then throw in another plot from nowhere just to keep things going for the rest of the story.
I couldn't help thinking during episode 4, oh, is it still on?
Yeah, and the big problem, I think, with it, or one of the big problems with it, is there's not enough there to justify its length. It's a bit boring, really.
It really is. And also, as any Bond fool know, you don't kill the villain before the henchman, way before the end of the story.
No, there's kind of nowhere else really to go with the Draster, but she still was the most interesting thing about the story. Partly because the actress was giving such a ridiculously funny, over-the-top, 70s diva villainess performance. She's from the mould of Serverland.
Marga.
And, as you said, Teabag.
Yeah, she really reminded me of the Elizabeth Essenson Teabag, although now I am distracted in my head by imagining a whole different version of The Good Life, where Marga lives next door, but... she was very watchable, and it is nice having, I mean, I like villains anyway as characters in Doctor Who, but it's nice having a female villain in particular, which, you know, there's not a massive scarcity of, but it does make for a different dynamic to the show, and particularly when she's got a female sidekick as well in the form of Old Mother off of An Unearthly Child.
And Romana in the first episode is mistaken for the commander because they assume that women are in charge, which is great, except that there's a rather misjudged line that comes very soon after where I think it's Old Mother says, I didn't think, Doctor, you were the kind of man who would be led by a woman.
Yeah, you wouldn't be a subordinate.
No, and then...
Well, to be fair, they don't say you'd be led by a woman. It's more he has such presence of his own that whoever he was with, he would be in charge. But it doesn't help that.
Yeah, I kind of agree, except then in the fourth episode, everyone seems to be taking a lot of delight in putting Adrastor in her place and the Huntsman suddenly turning on her.
Everything is back as it should be.
The Doctor laughing as he drags her across the room and forces her into Erato's embrace. There is a slightly unpleasant women know your place kind of subtext to it, which I don't really like, but I think is there. But that's not perhaps the worst prejudice on display in the story.
What is the worst prejudice on display? Oh, are you thinking of the...
The kind of anti-fat people metaphor. You know, fat people just want to love and hug and crush you as they wobble towards you.
I didn't get that. That's what you were, where you were going at all.
No. That's obviously not.
I thought you were going towards the fact that I don't know how to describe them. Yeah, the guy's running around stealing metal. The leader of whom is basically Fagin.
Yes, it's very uncomfortable, isn't it? with a whole group of people who are basically stereotypical Jews grasping after money and talking in that horrible stage Jew
voice. I'm not sure they all were, but particularly the leader guy.
The leader was,
he is very much like, I have my band of pickpockets with me.
Mm.
And disappointingly, they didn't actually break out into any fun songs, which would have livened up the story no end.
No, I think that's racially suspect. I think despite having a woman villain and a woman henchman, there's a slightly unpleasant sexist undertone to the story.
I had to check the recording dates, actually, because there's that bit where Tom says to Adrasta, you know, to the crazed female leader, care for your people for a change. And I thought, well, this is going out in 1979, and I don't know to what extent Thatcher has that image yet that is being satirised by Helen A, but actually it was recorded in April 79, so it's not as if she was even Prime Minister, even if they maybe expected that. It's a bit early to be making that kind of satire about Thatcher.
Although she had been Leader of the Opposition since 1975, but yeah, I take your point, it was before people really knew what Thatcher was going to do or be capable of.
We mentioned Lala as being mistaken for the commander, and it's interesting because this is we watched her last story for season 18, Warrior's Gate, and this is actually the first story she recorded as Romana.
Yeah.
So she's kind of settling in, and she's very, her costume is very Mary Tam still.
Oh, the costume's horrible though.
But you know, it's going for that kind of tall, stately, white robe thing that you know is a bit like Mary Tam's Rebos Operation outfit.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought of that, but I know, I'm sure I've read somewhere that she wasn't happy with the way that she was dressed in this story, and I think it's really notable that in later stories in the season she gets, in City of Death she gets the schoolgirl outfit, then she gets the kind of female Tom outfit. So this is the only one where she's dressed in a conspicuously Mary Tamish way. But she, in that first scene, she wears that horrible kind of pinny thing. It's just vile.
Mm.
I don't know what's going on with her costume.
What's apparently happening in that opening scene is that she's doing the housework in the TARDIS.
Yes, it is a bit like that, isn't it? Oh, Doctor, while you read K-9 Beatrix Potter, I'm going to do a clean-out. It's very domestic.
Mm.
Women know your place.
The thing that struck me the moment they arrived, and then continued to strike me, David Fisher wrote The Androids of Tara, didn't he?
Yes.
This is basically a cut-price Androids of Tara. They kind of arrive on this green and luscious, quite medieval world where people wander around with pikes, and there's a kind of faux aristocracy set up. There's, strange creatures in the forest, people going around, like, whipping away. It really, really reminded me of Tara from the previous season. Romana gets kidnapped and demonstrates exactly the same kind of aloofness that I had a problem with when we watched The Androids of Tara, with the idea she doesn't really, you know, it's good for her character in a way, because it makes her feel like a confident character, but at the same time, she just doesn't seem threatened by the situation, and it undermines it as a dramatic situation. And I thought that when Romana was lying in the surgeon's office in Tara, and I thought it again here, where she's surrounded by the local villains. There's a bit where Adrasta slaps Romana, and I think there's a bit where Grendel slaps the Doctor.
And the Doctor grabs his glove
and slaps him back in Tara. There were just lots of little things, and overall as well, it's not just Romana's aloofness. In Tara, one of my problems, if you remember, was everyone's like an aristocrat, and we have no idea really what the normal Tarans are like and what's actually at stake for anyone.
Jews. They're all Jews.
Yeah, David Fisher. Whereas, you know, and it's the same here. Yes, you get a little bit with the kind of thieves, but, you know, they're kind of playing a plot role in the story. You've got no real idea of what is at stake on Chloris, who the people are. It's just who's running the planet and the aristocracy poncing around. And I don't really feel like there are real people or anything really at stake in this world. And I felt the same way about Tara.
I hear what you're saying. I think, though, that that's not necessarily a problem with David Fisher's writing. I think that's probably the case in a lot of old Doctor Who. It's not about the kind of small people.
Oh, yeah.
It's always about the big important events. I think Robert Holmes is a funny exception, isn't he? Because he always has characters like Garron and Unstoff who and Binro the Heretic, who who adds some kind of extra texture to the world, like in the Sunmakers. It's all about those dispossessed people, but a lot of...
But it's fine in a way when it's set on Earth, because we take as read that, you know, Earth is at stake. But I think if you're creating an alien world, you do have to go that extra mile. And even in the Pirate Planet, you've got the kind of normal people living in the houses and stuff.
Yeah, maybe it is a David Fisher
thing. In State of Decay, you've got the normal people on the planet.
Yeah, you do have the persons. Yeah, fair point.
And fair enough, you know, you've got a small cast, you haven't got a lot of time, but, you know, you could have fleshed out that plot with an idea of who the people on the planet are, and it's all busy doing its court intrigue.
David Fisher is given lots of praise in some recent writing about season 17 and the kind of Graham Williams era as a whole. He's called out as one of the key writers of the time. I think he does write, he writes, what, four... three and a half stories for Graham Williams. He wrote the two in season 16, this one, and he wrote the basis for City of Death, but it was a gamble with time. I mean, City of Death is great, but it was basically written by Douglas Adams and Graham Williams. Androids of Tara, I think we agreed, was good, but it wasn't amazing. Creature from the Pit is not really that great. The Leisure Hive, which wasn't for Williams, but it was... presumably commissioned by Williams, and it is a bit of a mess, but was probably massively rewritten by Bidmead. So it's kind of...
And he wrote The Stones of Blood as well, didn't he?
He doesn't have... Yeah, he does. He did. But he doesn't have a kind of great hit rate in the three seasons that he writes for. A lot of his stories are massively rewritten, and the ones that aren't massively rewritten, apart from Stones of Blood, are not that great.
I mean, I don't think Androids of Tara is that bad, but it's a bit heartless in its core, if I remember. I'm trying to remember.
It's a very straight pastiche of the source material. It doesn't really add much to it.
Whereas the Stones of Blood, I think, is brilliant.
It is, yeah. That's a masterpiece. But he has kind of one great story and then one okay one, one that doesn't really work, and two that were massively rewritten by the script editor.
I mean, there's a lot of what I would put down as Douglas Adams touches in this script, although I don't know how much of that is Fisher being of the same kind of style anyway. You know, obviously, the thing about the Teach Yourself Tibetan book is completely Douglas Adams, and he reuses that in, is it Dirk Gently or something like that? He reuses that gag. Yeah,
probably. He was a notorious self-plagiarist.
But there's a lot of gags in this story, and they are not particularly clever gags. There's a lot of obvious jokes, and in some cases jokes at the expense of the story. In Tara and The Sense of Blood, and even things like City of Death, the jokes are kind of part of the story. In Creature from the Pit, they feel a bit forced, and at times, I mean, like when the Doctor first touches Irato's communicator translator thing, and he starts using the Doctor's voice, there's this ridiculous back-and-forth business of the Doctor going, I don't know what happened, do you know what happened, I don't know what happened, do you know what? And we're sitting there going, we've worked out ages ago that they're bringing him the communication thing, and you've now seen it happening, and you're just doing this thing for comedy purposes, slowing it all down.
I agree. That seems to be a moment where the production staff have tried to be more clever than the script, and it seems like David Fisher probably had one eye on the budget that he knew he was going to get and thought, well, I'll just have Tom Baker saying these lines while he's touching the communicator. And someone in the production team has said, oh no, we'll do it as a voiceover with flashing lights. And actually that works against the dialogue and the whole thrust of the scene, because the whole point is Irato's meant to be using the Doctor's larynx. So you should see his mouth moving. People think he's talking, they wouldn't think he's talking if he's not moving his mouth.
He's just standing there with his mouth shut, and you go, well, how are we hearing his voice? Which is much more echoey, and you know, and it's being played in, and it's much more like the kind of sound has been adopted by Irato for communication purposes. But yeah, but unfortunately, the dialogue says he's using the Doctor's larynx, and he clearly isn't.
I don't want to make too much of it, but it kind of, for me, typifies one of the big problems with the Williams stuff, which is that none of the departments necessarily seem to communicate with each other, and they all throw some ideas in and they all have a view, and there doesn't seem to be a strong creative force saying, no, this is how it should be. So you then obviously have people like Tom ad-libbing wildly, and I'm sure doing the kind of blowjob on Erato as a joke in studio, and no one really controlled it.
Well, let's just pause there for a moment and consider... I mean, I've obviously seen brief clips of that before, but I haven't seen the story before, and I was genuinely quite shocked at how fellaty that was. I thought, oh, there's a bit where, like, Tom bends down and tries to talk into this thing, and I've seen clips of it. Oh, no, he is giving a blowjob to the giant green blob. It's absolutely amazing that they thought that was an appropriate thing to put in a family TV show.
That's probably where some of the accusations of things like undergraduate humour come from, because the only people who would find that funny are teenage boys, really. You and I look at it and think, well, that's not really appropriate for a family series and it's a bit tacky.
Mm.
Kids won't get it. So the only people that would find it even vaguely amusing are adolescent boys.
The design itself actually isn't something I have a major problem with. You know, it's nice to have a different kind of alien who's a big green blob as opposed to just a man in a rubber suit. I think it's nice to have that variation. My problem really is how it's then used. It's things like Tom blowing into his tube, and just the cliffhanger at the end of episode 2, which is the thing moving forward a bit and the Doctor's scarf going under it, and it just kind of sitting on top of him like Mr. Blobby. It's one of the worst cliffhangers I've ever seen in Doctor Who.
Well, one of the worst cliffhangers, until the next cliffhanger is the villain being a bit distressed because someone's stuck a talisman on a giant blob.
It's very odd. It's one of those odd moments. And we've seen it a few times. I can't remember which other stories it was, but we definitely commented on it before, where the villain being in peril was a cliffhanger instead of the Doctor being in peril.
Was there an episode where Salamander? I can't.
No, remember. There's an episode of The Underwater Menace where isn't the cliffhanger that the king or someone is being attacked in the.
That's the one that ends with nothing in the world can stop.
Yeah, and it's not actually the Doctor. I mean, yes, that's where the Doctor is threatened by that, but it's not him who's just been attacked. Maya Francis sells the idea that Adrasta is scared. But it's a very odd thing for the viewer to, like, I've got to tune in next week to find out if the villain gets away.
How will Lady Adrasta get out of this one?
Yeah, and with one bound she was free and then she was dead.
For me, it's a story that it's hard to pay a huge amount of attention to. I have some issues with what I perceive to be a bit of sexism and anti-Semitism in it. I have some issues with the fact that none of the departments seem to be working together that effectively. I have some issues with David Brierley's K-9 because it's just not Patch or John Leeson.
This is the first one that David Brierley recorded as well. And I think in the first scene, he seems to be trying a bit to do the voice. And then as the story goes on, and admittedly K-9's supposed to be like drained of power a bit, but he does seem to just give up and just do whatever voice he feels like doing as the story goes on. It's not hard. You know, K-9 is not the hardest voice in the world to imitate, and he does just seem to stop.
Affirmative.
He stops even bothering to do that as the story goes on. Also, K-9 itself is just being used as a gun by the end. He's literally been carried around, pointed at things to shoot them.
He does become a bit of a gun platform.
I mean, that happens in a lot of stories, but I mean, he really is. He's actually being like wielded.
Yeah.
You know how he's referred to as the tin dog in School Reunion, and a bit about Mickey being the tin dog. In this story, they call him the tin dog, and I'm not sure that really happens anywhere else. Lady Adrasta calls him the electric dog at one point. I mean, is there any indication that the Chlorists, they even know about electricity?
Sounds like an 80s new romantic band, doesn't it?
Electric dog.
I mean, I feel like I'm being very down on the story. I didn't enjoy it massively. However, I think there's lots of admirable things about it. The first scenes on Chloris, I said to you, were like Kill the Moon meets In the Forest of the Night. It's this quite impressive, much more impressive than Kinder, let's be honest, forest.
That's a really jungle good planet. A really good forest.
With a giant egg.
Yeah. I have to say, I was sitting through that scene going, you can poke at it all you like, Doctor, I really don't care what the egg is. I didn't, and he was, you know, he's there just spending ages talking to himself, staring at this egg, and I'm like, I really, you're not making this sound like an exciting mystery. You're going, we've stumbled across a thing which there isn't even a, you know, is the whole story is directed quite well. Chris Barry is doing a good job, and there's lots of handheld stuff. But at the same time, I'm going, I don't even get a proper view of that egg for ages.
Yeah.
And then when I do, I don't really care. And then the doctor says things like, it looks like it's woven. I'm like, no, I can see it. It does not look like it's woven.
And then he gets attacked by what looks like some hairy bogeys.
Well, which are playing like Grandma's footsteps with him in the most obvious way.
I just found that quite funny, to be fair.
I think it could have been done a bit better. Because it looked like he was turning and staring at them and they were moving, and it needed to be cut slightly differently so that he was definitely not facing them when they were rolling towards him.
His face just made me laugh.
It did have that. I liked the...
And when he shouted, Romana!
It was one of the most... That bit at the beginning was like almost like Doctor Who by numbers. And again, I think it happens in Tara as well. But basically, they've arrived on a planet where there are two factions against each other, and the companion gets kidnapped by one and the doctor goes off with the other. It's like... I wouldn't insult Terence Dicks by saying Terence Dicks, but like Terence Dicks' big book of how to write a Doctor Who story would tell you to land on a planet. There's two factions. There we go. Probably David Fisher's big book of how to write a Doctor Who story tells you that.
Yeah, I suppose he kind of uses that again a little bit in The Leisure Hive with the Famazi and the Argolin.
I mean, you know, it's just, you know, dramatic principle. You've got to have some tension between two or more people. Mm. So if you're going to create a world, put some people at odds with each other on it.
I can't say I really noticed that, particularly in The Creature from the Pit.
I noticed it really at the beginning, when Romana was taken off by one group and right. The Doctor's taken off by the others. But that group then played no really important part in the plot at all.
I mean, what I noticed about it really was just it dragged, and I don't think there was enough there to sustain it for four episodes. And I think, despite the really nice film work in the kind of jungle.
It's boring in studio.
It's still obviously constrained with very few studio sets. It wasn't the worst thing, but I think there's much better season 17 stories than The Creature from the Pit.
Mm. Yeah, that's just about true. I'm just thinking through them.
Well, there's at least two that are much, much better, and probably three.
City of Death's better, Nightmare of Eden's better.
Yeah.
Not sure I would go out on a limb for any of the others.
The Shard is probably, if you count it, I'm not better.
Really Shard, because who knows how what that really would have been like.
Nine and Destiny are probably not as good.
So yeah, shoddy, or dodgy studio stuff. Departments not talking to each other. Let's just check with Eric Saywood.
Well, I don't like to point the finger, but in this case, I think it has to be firmly pointed at the production unit manager, John Nathan Turner.
On the upside, it is a bit improved when Jeffrey Belden turns up, just because, you know, Jeffrey Belden improves things. But then, even then, the script doesn't really know what to do with him and just starts doing astrology jokes to death. And by joke, I use joke in the loosest sense. He just keeps getting lines about what's happening in the stars over and over and over. And you go, this character has no role anymore, does it?
There's a kind of a solid sci-fi idea in it. This idea of a creature that has loads of metal but wants to get kind of chlorophyll. It's a bit... I'm sure there's a Star Trek episode with some kind of relatively benign creature that lives in some caves and the colonists are trying to kill it, whereas it's just trying to defend its young.
Exactly like a Star Trek episode.
But it feels very much cut from that cloth.
Yeah.
It feels like someone's probably seen... I think it's called The Devil in the Dark or something like that. It feels very much like it could have been a decent enough 45-minute episode of a sci-fi series.
And I'm picturing David Fisher ringing up Terry Nation and saying, Terry, I've got a planet where it's full of plants and they sell chlorophyll, and I just can't think of a name for this. Have you got any suggestions, Terry?
Plantos.
Foliages. Hang on.
Chloris!
The only two other notes that I did scribble down, one was actually Romana could have done a lot better work at the beginning with her housework, because the roundels are incredibly dirty.
Oh, I didn't notice.
They need a proper old clean-up. They need taking out, you know, probably washing in some nice soapy water for a while and then putting back in. They are grubby as hell.
Oh, there's nothing worse than a dirty roundel.
It really, really isn't. And the, my opinion, my actual favourite line, even though it probably does class as the undergraduate humour level, is a jester going, "We call it the creature." Hannah going, "Very original."
There are lots of funny one-liners, aren't there? There were bits that made me laugh, but it just didn't sustain my attention. And it's not a story that I've watched loads and loads and am hugely familiar with. I just found it quite dull in parts.
Yeah, I'd never seen it before. I should have been quite engaged with the detail. And the more it went on, the more it lost me.
Yeah. And the last episode, I was just thinking, oh, well, Adrastus died now. Why are we dragging this out?
Yeah. We're gonna use aluminium to protect against a neutron star. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So, we were not overwhelmed by the creature from the pit, I think it's fair to say.
Not blown away, unlike Erato.
fellatio joke. That one's not going down as a good one. I'm not going to give it head position on the season 17 list. Teenage boys there. So, we will get out our randomisers and see which season they're going to blow us to.
Oh, go on then.
Okay, the randomiser is powered up and running. We've changed the programming of the randomiser slightly because at the time we started, it went up to series 7. And that was our 35th, quote, active year of Doctor Who. We are adding Season 7B, the second half of that, along with Day of the Doctor and Time of the Doctor as an additional active year, 2013, and Series 8, the Capaldi season, for the 37th active year. We did have 8 seasons left to go. We've now got 10. So that does mean also there's a 1 in 5 chance that one of those new seasons will be what we picked. So, let's get the randomizer going. Well, the randomizer has spoken.
Only in your head.
I touched it and it used my larynx.
Yeah.
So, randomizer, what have you chosen? Hello, Will. Apologies for the inconvenience in taking over your voice. That's what Erato says. I have chosen season 14. Well, thank you, Randomizer, for that interesting choice. The one remaining Tom Baker season
Okay. That
we haven't done yet, so we're sticking with Tom. And that means it is
The Mask of Mandragora,
The Hand of Fear,
The Deadly Assassin,
The Face of Evil, Robots of Death, and
The Talons of Wang Chiang.
Ooh, that's a tricky bunch. 6 stories there.
Well, we could go for some more racism after the Jews got it in the neck. In The Creature from the Pit, we could go for the Chinese in The Talons of Wang Chiang.
Or the robots. God, they really get it in Robots of Death.
It's an exceptionally good series of Doctor Who, isn't it? There isn't really a bad story out of the 6.
No, there are stronger and weaker ones, but there's nothing terrible. And there are a few very good ones. Pondering. I think there's 3 I want to rule out.
Okay. 50%?
Well, I'm thinking...
Narrows it down?
It does narrow it down. I was just thinking, rather than going through them in turn, I think there's reasons for certain ones where I would suggest not doing them. I'd suggest not doing Robots of Death, just because I have seen it quite recently. I went to see the BFI screening of it, which was good, and had a panel with Tom and Louise and people afterwards. But I've even seen it since that... Okay. Since then as well, so...
Fair enough.
I don't think I want to watch that. I don't really want to watch The Deadly Assassin, kind of feel. I don't know, maybe I've got interesting things to say about it, but I kind of feel like I've slightly watched The Deadly Assassin.
Deadly Death.
Unless you want to pitch in for The Deadly Assassin.
I'm intrigued by your third exemption.
It's The Hand of Fear. Again, I feel like I've watched it enough, and there's other more interesting stuff in this season.
I had one exemption, which is different from...
Was it Talons?
No, it's The Face of Evil, because I've watched it relatively recently. So that leaves us with a straight choice between the Mask of Mandragora and the Talons of Wang Chiang.
Yeah, I was quite interested in Face of Evil, but I haven't seen Mandragora for ages. And I haven't seen it that many times in total. So
no,
I haven't. It's one of those ones I remember having. Remember reading the novelisation of at school more than I remember watching it.
The main thing I remember about it is that the video had a strange variant of the normal kind of rounded font. You know that kind of round font that you see? And usually the M's had straight sides, and on the Mask of Mandragora the M's had slanted sides, and I have no idea why.
That title sequence, something, is it, it's not the light or something at the top, something goes brown, doesn't it, in some of the titles?
In the season 12 titles, they use different washes, so I think there's a blue one, a brown one, a green one, and then they decided just to use the kind of blue one.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, so I'm interested. On the other hand, I kind of, after having sat through a not very good story just now, I'm a bit like, can we just remind ourselves why Doctor Who is good with Talons? On the other hand, I've seen Talons a million times, and although I quite fancy watching it, I'm not sure there's anything left to be said about it, almost. It's been kind of talked about. Every interesting part of it, everybody knows.
Hmm.
Aren't Jago and Lightfoot interesting characters? They're like a double act.
A Holmesian double act.
Oh, isn't it funny when the body gets pulled out of the water and that woman says a funny thing about onions? I like that. Oh, it's a little bit racist, isn't it?
Should we watch The Mask of Mandragora? Because I think neither of us are very familiar with it. I'm sure it will be quite interesting for us. Might not be interesting for anyone listening, if anyone is still listening after a hiatus bit. I think it will be interesting for us.
Yeah, my only worry with that is I remember not being very excited by it the last time I watched it. But maybe it'll be better this time.
It was Philip Hinchcliffe's among his favourite of the ones he did. I think he personally requested that it be included in the five faces of Doctor Who as the representation from his era.
Who was it?
No.
No, I didn't think it was.
Because...
What did they show instead?
They showed Legopolis instead.
Oh, because they were showing it just before Cash Revolver.
And it was the only one that could justify five faces, wasn't it? Because I think they did an Unearthly Child, Crotons, Three Doctors, Carnival of Monsters. So you've got two Pertwees and then Legopolis.
Fair enough. Weird, but fair enough. Okay, well, let's do the Mask of Mandragora. Unless you're tempted. Again, the Deadly Assassin, like everything's been said about the Deadly Assassin.
I could watch The Deadly Assassin, but the main thing that I remember about The Deadly Assassin is that a huge chunk of it is just a massive run around inside the Matrix with lots of gruesome imagery, but no real story.
The much lauded surrealist dream sequence that, yeah. Let's go for Mandragora.
Mandragora is...
You could sound more excited. Mandragora
is! Mandragora is!
Excellent. So tune into episode 29 of Seasons of Taste and find out what taste we found the Mask of Mandragora having.
Vanilla.
Okay, that's spoiled that now. We know what it is. Bye!
Bye!
Bye!